There we go. Thank you very much, George. So what I'm going to talk today, as George said, is about investment, which I didn't actually know what the Treasurer was going to speak about, but I had a guess he might have mentioned investment beforehand. So I'm going to take some of the stuff he said and talk about it in a bit more detail. So one of the ongoing themes in the global economy since the financial crisis has been the long-lasting lack of business investment spending right around the world. And this has been despite conditions that in the past have been very favourable for investment spending, such as low borrowing rates, strong corporate balance sheets, and solid corporate profitability. So while that's been true globally, in Australia the story's actually been quite different, although a lot of people seem to blissfully ignore it. Investment spending here has actually been at an historically high level over much of the past decade, not an historically low level. And this has been primarily due to the strength of investment in the resources sector, obviously, which reached its highest share of activity in more than a century. So unlike in other countries, there has been a significant addition to the capital stock in Australia over the past decade. And a lot of people happily exclude the resource sector when they're looking at investment, but that adds to the capital stock and generates money and income for the country just as much as any other investment spending in the country. So what we're seeing now is the fruits of that investment in the strong growth in resource exports. So today I'd like to compare and contrast the investment experience here with that of other countries, and also compare and contrast investment in the resources sector in Australia with investment in the rest of the economy, where the experience has been more similar to that elsewhere in the world, i.e. it hasn't been that strong up until recently. So as we're almost at the end of the resource investment cycle, stronger growth in investment in other sectors is important for future additions to the capital stock in Australia. So I'll spend some time discussing the recent history of investment in this part of the economy, drawing insights from a recently available data set that the ABS has put out that provides highly disaggregated information on the business sector. So let me start with what we're talking about here. So there's the share of investment spending in Australia over the last few decades, and as you can see, we actually hit a high over the past decade rather than a low, which has been the case in a lot of other countries. So we hit a multi-decade high around 2012-2013, and as you can see, obviously, it's a lot to do with the mining sector, but nevertheless, total investment was a highest share of GDP in more than five decades. And that stands in stark contrast to the experience in nearly every other advanced economy, as well as most emerging economies, with China obviously being a noteworthy exception. So you can see there that that's the sort of standard story, that investment takes a fairly large dive in 2008, sort of struggles to come back in most other areas of the economy, and in some places, particularly the euro area, hasn't even managed to recover yet. So as I said, much of the outcome for strong investment spending here was clearly a result of the record level of investment spending in the mining sector. So if we go back, that works, yep. So you can see there that investment spending in the mining sector rose from around 2% of GDP in the early 2000s, where it basically been for much of the previous five decades, to peak at around 9% of GDP in 2012-2013. Or to put that in dollar terms, investment spending in the mining sector in 2007 was $41 billion. It rose to a peak of $136 billion in 2012-13, so tripled in the space of about 6 years. The reasons for this huge rise in investment spending in the mining sector has been well documented. In the case of iron ore and coal, it was a response to the large rise in commodity prices through the 2000s, predominantly driven by the emergent and strong resource-intensive growth of China. Investment spending to increase capacity in the iron ore and coal industries accounts for around 40% of that rise in spending, of total spending over the past decade. A larger share has actually been spent in the LNG sector, and that's not only a China story. A large part of LNG exports also are destined for Japan and Korea, in fact, larger than are going to China. Many of those investment decisions, particularly in iron ore and coal, took place well before commodity prices peaked. So, you know, obviously, these projects are large with very long lead times. The average LNG project often takes more than 5 years to complete. So that's from start to finish, let alone how long there is to plan it ahead of time and get the approvals. The investment decisions were predicated on prices much lower than those subsequently seen through the height of the commodity price boom. They made these decisions to launch these big projects based on prices which were a hell of a lot lower than what actually turned out to be the case, which was nice. And price for iron ore and coal today still compare favourably with the level assumed when commissioning those projects. So they're still well in front of the numbers they actually assumed when these projects were initiated back around the middle of the 2000s. Obviously, since that peak in spending in 2012-2013, investment spending in the resource sector has declined as projects have been completed. As they have been completed, production has been ramped down. Production has been ramped up. So there's the decline in spending. What we're seeing now is why they actually did the investment spending in the first place. They just didn't do it for the hell of it. They did it to actually get stuff out of the ground and sell it. And so production has been ramped up, and we're now seeing the benefits of that with large increases in resource exports. So since 2007, iron ore export volumes have more than doubled, and coal export volumes have increased by 70%. Our assessment is the vast bulk of the increase in production for these commodities is now behind us, because there's only about a project or two still to be completed. So in the case of iron ore and coal, we're pretty much at peak capacity today. LNG is in a much earlier stage of the process. LNG exports have risen by 75% over the past 2 years, and our expectation is over the next couple of years, exports are likely to increase by a further one-third. At the end of that, LNG exports are likely to be about two-thirds of the value of iron ore exports and account for around 15% of total exports from Australia. So LNG exports will have gone from a fairly small share to being around 15% of what we sell to the rest of the world. With the increase in productive capacity of the resources sector and hence supply both here and in other parts of the world, naturally enough, prices have declined from their extremely high levels earlier this decade. That is, as all this production has come online, the prices have gone down. But as I said earlier, that's what the people who were doing these projects actually expected, and almost certainly they're still higher now than what they were anticipating when they first started those projects. It's interesting to think about the commodity price dynamics going forward. So if you have a sort of potted history of this part of the resources sector over the last couple of decades, through much of the 2000s, the growth in demand, mostly coming from China, vastly outstripped the growth in supply. So surprisingly, that we had extraordinarily large price increases. Then, over much of the past 5 years or so, supply growth has grossly outstripped the growth in demand, and prices have fallen considerably. So that's where we are roughly today. But looking forward, and most obviously in the case of iron ore and to some extent coal, there's not much more supply to come onto the market, at least that the market doesn't already know about. There's a bit to come on in Brazil yet, but that's already fairly known and on the assumption that markets are actually forward-looking, probably priced. So we've had this large increase in supply, but going forward, there's not much more to come. So really, the commodity price dynamics from here are very much dependent on what you think about the demand side of the market. So in the near term, the prices of coal and iron ore are going to primarily be affected by Chinese demand. So the supply dynamics have mostly run their course. We're really back into a world of demand dynamics. And that we've put out a bit of analysis on this issue, at least on the Chinese demand issue, in a box in the Statement of Monetary Policy last Friday. But it's worth keeping in mind this fairly simple point, that if you just maintain the level of demand around current levels, that actually supports prices around current levels because supply isn't growing anymore. If demand grows more than you think from here, prices will go up. And obviously, the conversely, if demand declines more than you expect from here, then prices will fall. But as I said, one thing which I think is often forgotten is we've had this level shift in supply. That's happened. It isn't happening again. What matters, but demand keeps on growing. Might not be growing all that much these days, but if it keeps on growing, that's going to put upward pressure in the face of constant supply. So following the significant addition to productive capacity from these large projects over the past decade, there has been a notable lack of exploration spending in recent years. So that means there's not much more prospect for any material increase in investment spending in the period ahead. So as a result, our expectation is that investment spending in the resources sector is going to bottom out just above 2% of GDP and stay at roughly that level for quite some time. Given the long lead times between exploration and actually thinking about a project and getting that project approved, given there isn't much exploration spending going on at the moment, there isn't much prospect for any large increase in investment spending in the resource sector anytime soon. Companies will primarily be just undertaking replacement spending to maintain their existing production capacity. And that outlook is very much consistent with what we get when we actually talk to these firms in our business liaison program, and it's also evident in the ABS CapEx survey. So what is the primary explanation for why investment in the mining sector has been so much stronger than in the non-mining sector and so much stronger than investment in other advanced economies? What's fairly obvious is because mining companies expected that demand in the future was going to be strong. All the other factors which enter into their investment decisions were very much the same as in other sectors of the economy. They had low borrowing costs, funding was was readily available, their balance sheets were strong. And one thing which is often worth pointing out, so uncertainty is often held out there as a reason why there's not much investment spending going on. There was a fair bit of uncertainty in the resource sector going back 10, 15 years or so. So there obviously wasn't any more or less than it was in any other sector of the economy. Indeed, given the long horizons for these projects, you can make the point that actually uncertainty was at least as large as it was in other sectors of the economy. But in the end, it basically boiled down to they had decent expectations for future demand and they went ahead and invested. So let me turn to investment in the non-mining sector. The sharp contraction in business investment during the financial crisis and the subsequent weak recovery has primarily been a phenomenon of advanced economies. There's been a large body of literature attempting to explain the underwhelming pickup in investment and has attributed to a range of factors, which I'll spend some time discussing. So let me just compare where we are in Australia compared to where we are in other countries. So non-mining investment in Australia today is around 17% higher than it was at the end of the first quarter in 2008. So we're nearly 10 years on, and it's only around 17% higher. So you can see that's not much growth in the meantime. By way of comparison, investment spending in the US has increased by about the same amount, by around about 17% over that 10-year period. While in the UK, it's risen by 13%, in Japan by 3%, and in the euro area, investment spending today, in levels terms, is 4% lower than where it was 10 years ago. So in all of these cases, this is a disappointingly low level of investment spending. So what's been holding it back? And so let me discuss some of the possible explanations. And in doing so, in the case of Australia, I will use some evidence from a new database from the ABS called Blade, which is basically firm-level database, which matches administrative records, including stuff from the ATO, with the data that the ABS gets from surveying companies. And it has it for nearly all Australian firms with data available over the past, from 2002 to 2015. So it's firm-by-firm level data on a whole bunch of stuff, annual data on capital spending, the size of their capital stock, their sales, their wages, and a number of other variables. And the data on capital purchases are well aligned with investment spending in the national accounts, which is good. And coverage is actually considerably larger than the capital expenditure survey. So this data actually provides a much broader snapshot or survey of what's going on in the investment side of the economy than does the capital expenditure survey, which I'll come back to later. So let me run, so we can use this data to run through some of the possible explanations. So a fairly obvious candidate to explain the post-crisis behaviour of investment is obviously weak aggregate demand. Research finds, not surprisingly, that much of the weakness in global investment since the crisis can be explained by slower economic growth, although that starts to get fairly circular fairly quickly. However, when we look at this in Australia, while the explanation clearly has a lot of attraction, there is less clear-cut evidence for non-mining business investment. Investment in spending in the non-mining sector has been even weaker than predicted by our standard aggregate model. That is, given how much demand actually grew, investment spending has still been surprisingly weak. So what we did was we examined firm-level data and found that corporate investment has been consistently weaker than would be predicted based on past relationships with Tobin's Q. But these results could mask heterogeneity across firms of different sizes. So one thing this database can do is that we can look at investment spending by big firms and by small firms, so with the dividing line here being sales above or below $2 million. So, for example, while the post-crisis weakness in non-mining investment has been broad-based across both large and small businesses, our analysis using this data shows that for large firms, this can be explained mostly by weakness in demand. In contrast, investment by small businesses in Australia over the past decade has been particularly weak since the crisis relative to current demand. Expectations of weak future conditions are obviously plausibly restraining in business investment even more than current conditions. So until recently, our liaison program pointed to businesses being reluctant to invest until they saw a sustained pickup in demand, which again, given the circular flow of income, becomes somewhat self-fulfilling. You don't expect there's going to be much pickup in demand, you don't invest, lo and behold, there's not much pickup in demand. Similarly, we've found evidence that weaker corporate sentiment is holding back investment for both US and Australian companies. So using estimates of corporate sentiment based on the share of negative words in each company's annual report. So at the moment, or over the past decade or so, there's a bit strong negative theme throughout companies' annual reports, and that's been reflected in their weak business investment spending. So they don't think things are going to be strong, they don't invest. More recently, though, investment intentions in business surveys and the bank's liaison contacts, the conversations we're having with our liaison contacts have become more positive alongside improved expectations for demand. So I said this is true in Australia, but it's particularly so in other countries, and most prominently in the US, but even in the euro area, if you look at measures of business sentiment, they're about as high as they've been for the past 10 years or so in both places. There may well be a large cross-border aspect to weakness of global investment over the past decade. Investment decisions taken by multinationals may be influenced by their assessment of conditions in their home market, particularly to the extent that it imposes funding constraints on their global operations. So one thing we get from our business liaison program here in talking to people who are working at multinationals is even if conditions here are reasonable, head office has said they don't particularly want to do investment, and that's restraining investment right around the world. I suspect it's also the fact that if people get together in places like Davos every January and talk about how bad the world is, and they all go away and think how bad the world is, even if their own country is actually not doing so bad. So hopefully that dynamic swings from being a negative dynamic into a positive dynamic. So again, as I said, there are signs that the generalised improvement in business sentiment is leading to a global reassessment of investment decisions. So those multinationals which had previously been reluctant to invest are now seeing signs that they are much more inclined to invest, and so that is generating a synchronised global upswing in investment spending. While the mining investment boom was in progress, there were very apparent positive spillovers to non-mining business investment in WA and Queensland, and then, as the Treasurer just said a minute ago, there was creating headwinds to investment in the rest of the country, particularly New South Wales and Victoria, in part because of the very elevated level of the exchange rate at the peak of the commodity boom. So one area of the economy where the negative effect of the high exchange rate on investment was very evident was in tourism. Now, liaison with the tourism sector says, so what they're doing now is they're saying, I'd wished I'd invested more going back over the past 5 years or so because the tourism demand now is extremely strong. I haven't done any investment. I'm having to catch up. And so, particularly when the exchange rate was high, they're extremely reluctant to invest, notwithstanding that a high exchange rate actually makes investment on average a bit cheaper. But they were reluctant to invest. Now the exchange rate's come down some, demand in the tourism sector is going along very strongly. They're sort of trying to catch up in a hurry on that investment spending they haven't done for most of the past decade. So what we're seeing now is as those forces have reversed, as mining investments come down, non-mining investment in Queensland and WA has declined along with the declining in mine investment, but it has risen noticeably in New South Wales and Victoria. So one thing which was somewhat of a surprise, is the spillovers both in the mining states and the non-mining states from the mining investment boom were much larger than you might have thought. And we can look at that again using this BLADE database, which shows that investment by firms in mining-exposed industries in Queensland and WA has declined sharply since 2012, whereas investment by firms in other industries has remained broadly unchanged. So the effect of the mining investment rise and fall has been amplified by the spillovers to investment spending in other parts of the states, of the state economies, and that dynamic is now flipped around now. Another explanation which is often advanced is why investment spending is low is if firms have become more risk averse or if they've reassessed the likelihood of bad outcomes. So you have a really bad outcome in 2008, causes people to reassess their expectations of future events, and to some extent there's a sort of lingering shock or trauma from that large collapse in spending in 2008, and it's taken people a long time to recalibrate their expectations. So it's difficult to differentiate between whether firms have just become more risk averse or if they've just reassessed expectations for the future economy. But there are signs that suggest that one or both have changed post-crisis. Liaison suggests some managers are much less willing to take risks and have tightened investment criteria since the crisis. Previous colleagues of mine had talked about the fact that hurdle rates have remained high in the post-crisis environment, even though funding costs have declined materially since then. Companies have reduced their gearing and increased their cash holdings, and as I said, hurdle rates do remain relatively high. They've come down some, but they haven't come down nearly as much as borrowing costs or financing costs. Related to the latter point is that there are some indications that the stock market is rewarding cost reduction rather than investment spending, where the payoffs are multi-year rather than immediate. That is, the risk aversion may be coming more from shareholders than it's coming from the company's executive or board. There appears to be a desire to have excess capital returned to shareholders through buybacks and dividends rather than utilising that capital for investment with uncertain returns. This is work we put out a little while back, and you can see in the post 2007-08 period, there's been a high dividend payout ratio. And dividends and buybacks, if you add them together, now are as high as they've ever been in the pre-crisis period. So shareholders want their money back rather than the firms going out and spending it on some uncertain investment project. But one thing which is worth pointing out is if businesses have a cost reduction mentality, that doesn't necessarily imply lower investment spending. Achieving greater automation or process efficiencies is quite likely to require some amount of capital spending. So the argument that there's less investment spending because of a focus on cost reduction doesn't quite square up. If anything, that should possibly imply more rather than less investment spending. Several studies suggest that heightened uncertainty has weighed on investment in a number of countries. Indeed, that's become somewhat of a cottage industry in the economics profession, is to come up with new and interesting way of measuring uncertainty and then showing it has some negative effect on investment spending. Our own work has found some evidence of a negative relationship between uncertainty and investment. But most measures of uncertainty for Australia have actually been at relatively low level in recent years. So while that might work in other parts of the world, it doesn't seem to quite work here. That said, uncertainty in the end is not really observable, and different uncertainty measures may well give you different outcomes. Let me now talk a bit about financing. As I said earlier, financing costs are about as low as they've been. And in normal circumstances, you would have expected that to lead to an increase in investment spending. But in other countries, financing constraints have been found to play a role in explaining weak investment outcomes. And that's mostly because of the state of their balance sheets, of the bank's balance sheets, and Europe being the prime case in point here. With weak bank balance sheets, they've been reluctant to lend to the corporate sector. And so financing constraints have been an issue there. That has clearly not been the case here in Australia. Our liaison with larger businesses says that the cost and availability of finance is not weighing on their investment in Australia. And as I said, aggregate indicators of borrowing costs are at low levels. But again, aggregate indicators of the availability of finance and borrowing costs hide a great deal of heterogeneity. So what we've done here is looked at average borrowing rates. This is straight off companies' annual reports. Looked at their average borrowing rates split up by large, medium, and small businesses. And you see for large companies, their borrowing costs are, not surprisingly, about as low as they've ever been. For medium companies, they're a bit lower. But for small companies, they've come down since the peak in 2009, but they're actually quite still a fair bit higher than they were pre-crisis. So obviously the tiering between the three is not surprising given the relative risk, but the fact that we're seeing a large decline in borrowing costs for large companies, which hasn't been reflected in companies of other sizes, I think is interesting. So finance is readily available for large companies, either through the banking system or through capital markets. But our liaison with small businesses indicates that the availability of finance is a much more binding constraint. And it's not necessarily a question of whether or not they get the loan approved. It's a lot, as in our liaison, a lot of it boils down to just how long it takes the loan approval process to go through for a small business. And in the meantime, they've still got to keep on existing. But for them to scale up and to get financing for an investment project takes them quite a considerably a long period of time. They may get the finance in the end, but it takes them a long period of time to get there. My colleague Chris Kent will talk about this in more detail next month. Another possible explanation is that non-mining investment is lower because the steady state investment to GDP ratio is lower than in the past. So what I'm talking about here is if you shift from capital intensive sectors to less capital intensive sectors in the economy, then investment spending in the end is going to be lower than in the past. And one reason which is often put forward around this is that the service sector has less capital intensive, it's less capital intensive than the goods sector of the economy, and clearly the service sector is a much bigger sector of the economy now than it used to be. But it's worth remembering that not all service sectors are not capital intensive. If you think about parts of the health services industry, they're incredibly capital intensive. If you think other services, clearly like education, maybe not quite so capital intensive, but services doesn't equal low capital intensity. That said, when we look at this argument, we don't see much evidence for it. The biggest shift in relative capital intensity has been within sectors. So that means within the manufacturing sector, we're seeing a shift to lower capital intensity. Within the health sector, we're seeing a shift to lower capital intensity. It's not a question that we're shifting from a high capital intensive sector to a low capital intensive sector. The other challenge for those theories is to explain why structural factors only emerged in the post-crisis period. That is, why has that only been true over the past 10 years and wasn't true before then? One of the large debates going on, again, at the moment, is whether actually measuring capital investment, particularly around the new technologies which are emerging, as well as we might. So if you could go back 30, 40 years now, Bob Silo was famous for saying that the computers were everywhere except in the national accounts data. Now, eventually they did turn out there, but it took a lot longer than people expected. And what we're seeing now, perhaps, is somewhat of a manifestation of that. Again, there's a large amount of investment spending, there's a large amount of technology being adopted in the economy at the moment, but we're not necessarily seeing that reflected in the national accounts. So it's there, it's just not necessarily been captured. So that said, notwithstanding all those explanations as to why investment spending is low, there have been signs of life, finally, in investment spending outside the resources sector. And it turns out, actually, after some data revisions over the last year or so, those signs of life in investment spending have actually been there for a bit longer than we thought they had been. So we'd been expecting non-mining investment spending to grow, be picking up for quite some time, kept on disappointing, not picking up, and then the statistician changed the history, and lo and behold, it has been picking up for the last 2 years. So it's good when your theories. So we were noticing this disconnect between what we were hearing about and what we expected to happen, and what was actually being recorded in the data, and for once, the data adjusted to the theories rather than the theory adjusted to the data, which was good. So it now appears that there's been a solid upward trajectory in non-mining business spending in Australia over the past couple of years. So where has that growth been? So everyone says, well, you know, this investment spending is picking up. I don't see it. So the annual national accounts data, which the ABS put out just recently, indicate that much of the growth in investment spending in recent years has been in the services sector. And this comes back to what I was saying earlier. Services sector doesn't necessarily mean low investment spending. And in part because services also includes things like information, media, and telcos, as well as health. One thing to note is that the service sector doesn't have good coverage in the ABS Capital Expenditure Survey, particularly health and education. The Capital Expenditure Survey covers only around half of investment spending in the non-mining sectors. So it's not a particularly comprehensive guide to either the current level or the outlook for aggregate non-mining investment. The other area of investment that has been robust of late has been in those parts of the economy associated with infrastructure spending. So there's been a clear pickup in growth of public investment in recent years, and you just heard the Treasurer talking about that in the New South Wales context a few minutes ago. A share of these projects have been completed by the private sector on behalf of the public sector. So some of that's actually recorded as private investment in the national accounts as the work occurs. And that's boosted investment growth both as a direct consequence of the infrastructure spending and increasingly in spillovers to other parts of the economy. So just as I said earlier that we saw much larger spillovers from the mining investment spending, both positive and negative, over the past 10 years or so, what we are seeing now is very large spillovers from the infrastructure spending, particularly in New South Wales and Victoria, to the other parts of the state economies. So in the end, where I want to get to is say a common global theme in the post-crisis environment has been the lack of investment. So that's been a strong global story over the past decade or so. One of the points I want you to take away from this talk is that hasn't been the story in Australia over the past decade. Indeed, it's been close to the opposite, with investment spending actually reaching a multi-decade peak back in 2012. Secondly, the strength of investment spending in Australia has been clearly associated with the mining industry and the spillovers, both positive and negative, of that to investment in other parts of the economy. And those spillovers have probably been greater than we might have thought ex ante. And third, I went through a number of potted explanations as to why investment spending in the non-mining sector in Australia has been weak. But in the end, the most powerful reason boils down to firms' expectations of future demand, otherwise known as animal spirits. Firms didn't expect the economy to be all that strong, so they didn't invest. And because they didn't invest, to some extent, that's why the economy wasn't all that strong. Mining investment, on the other hand, was strong because expectations for future demand were high, and there wasn't much that much uncertainty around that expectation. Expectations of demand elsewhere hadn't been strong, but now we're starting to see that dynamic change. We're seeing it changing here in Australia, and we're seeing it change elsewhere in the world. And as I mentioned earlier, there's not only spillovers within the economy from one sector to another, but there does seem to be some global element to the investment cycle, in part because of the role of multinationals in investment, but also because there seems to be a strong global element to animal spirits in the corporate sector globally. So as I said, we're seeing that dynamic changing here and elsewhere in the world. With any luck, it will be sustained. Because in our case, it will be timely, because as the mining investment story draws to its close over the rest of this year, we do need investment in the rest of the economy to pick up and continues those additions to the capital stock, which ultimately is what we need to improve the welfare of the Australian people. All right, so let me finish there, and happy to take questions that people might have. I suppose stick up your hand if you want to ask a question. Roy. Hang on. I don't promise to identify every questioner by first name.
Rory Robertson, Westpac Treasury Group. Dr. Bell, thanks for your presentation. My brief summary is that the bank sees the business investment outlook as quite positive. The glass is more than half full. I say that because on Friday the Reserve Bank published its quarterly statement on monetary policy, and in that statement the bank published forecasts showing that it thinks that the business investment with infrastructure investment and consumption is going to be strong enough to drive the unemployment rate gradually lower. So currently 5.5%, and the bank's outlook is over the next 2 years it might edge down further. At the same time, the Reserve Bank's publishing an inflation forecast that has underlying inflation at 1.75%, and it's sort of flat to up. It's sort of edging up over the next 2 years to about 2%, which is the bottom of the Reserve Bank's 2-3% band. So my question is on the policy outlook. You know, are we right to think that with the economy going okay, but inflation sort of low and stable and struggling to get back to 2%, that the case for monetary tightening is weak, and so we're stuck with a record low cash rate for, say, the next 6 months at least?
I don't think I'm being quite that precise on the outlook for monetary policy, Rory. That's what you're paid to do, not me. I just get paid to think about above 5 months. I think one thing expect that increase in investment spending to keep going. I think the other thing, which is, you know, the infrastructure spending upswing is well and truly there. It's pretty obvious, extremely obvious in this state. And as the Treasurer said earlier, it's going to keep on going for a while yet. And I think at least in that case, there are potentially positive spillovers. One thing I think which is interesting to think about, and coming back to what you were talking about in terms of employment, is that businesses are now appear to be willing to increase investment spending. Employment growth has actually been pretty strong as well. So they're both hiring people and they're willing to increase investment spending. And I suppose, I think one thing, the missing part of the puzzle, which partly comes to what you were talking about, inflation, is whether as the labour market gets a bit tighter, whether the going to get around to the point of being willing to actually increase wages. And partly comes back to what I was talking about earlier, is that for most of the past decade, cost reduction has very much been at the top of mind for a lot of businesses. And so while you've got that at the top of mind, you're not particularly interested in thinking about increasing wages. But as you're starting to increase your investment spending, as you're starting to hire up more people, that ultimately should start to absorb some of the excess capacity, and you might actually get to the point where you might have to actually think about paying someone a bit more to actually get them to walk in the door. And we don't think we've quite got to that point yet, as we said on Friday. But I think if that business mindset is actually changing, maybe we do get there at some point, sooner rather than later. But at the same time, we've seen this dynamic play out all around the world. Cost reduction, again, I think, is very, very much at top of mind in globally as well as locally, and it's taken a long time in the rest of the world for that mindset to change and for people, businesses to be start willing to increase wages. Hasn't changed, obviously, yet globally, and I suppose that's one thing, that's one of the risks. So just as there may be positive upside from the infrastructure spending, there's still that negative, that risk on the downside, that wages still increase a lot, they remain stubbornly low a lot longer than we're anticipating, and at least that's what seems to have been the case globally, and the question is how relevant that is locally. But I do think the fact that we're starting to see a change in mindset from the corporate sector around the willingness to invest, around the willingness to hire, gives you some hope that eventually we might get back into a world where we start to see those wage and price pressures emerge.
Thanks very much.
Australia described as a variable rate economy. Could you just elaborate your thinking on vulnerability of Australia to external or internal shocks in relation to household debt levels?
From my point of view, actually, the fact that we have variable rate mortgages has actually been a good buffer over most of our history, in a way that's not quite so true elsewhere in the world. So I suppose, are we just going to jack up rates to see how the household sector lives with that? I don't think so. So I know a lot of people, if rates were materially higher, then the household sector would have trouble servicing their mortgages. So, yep, we know that. And I think you have to think about what the environment is that the rates are going to be going up in. It's going to be an environment where the economy is stronger, where nominal growth in the economy is stronger, where household incomes are actually rising. It's not, as I said, it's not, I personally don't see something where, some set of circumstances where it just happens. As I said, so it will be in the context of the nominal inflation and wage increases in the economy are stronger than they are now. As I said, I just don't see that shock which comes along which causes rates to go up in an environment when those other things aren't the case. So, and that's been true. It's been true pretty much throughout our history. So I don't see any change in that, in the dynamics in the economy now, where suddenly, as I said, there's just an exogenous. Well, as I said, it's not a, upward pressure on rates isn't exogenous. It's endogenous, I suppose, is another way of putting it. There's nothing which comes along, I don't think, which forces us to raise interest rates. We will do it because the circumstances in the economy warrant it. And as I said, that will be a world where that we're looking at a stronger nominal outcomes in the economy. So, I know it generates nice headlines to say, well, if we interest rates were 4 percentage points higher than they are now, the household sector would struggle. It's like, yep, if that was happened today, indeed that would be the case. But that's not that's not the sort of scenario in which that sort of element is likely to occur. It will be monetary policy is endogenous to the state of the economy, not exogenous. And then behind you.
Dr. DeBell, Matthew Johnson, UBS. Dr. DeBell, thank you for the enlightening speech. You did say that that when you talked about signs of life and investment, finally, so the RBA, other central banks, UBS as well, in various economies have called a false dawn before. How high is your confidence that business investment is picking up? And then related to that, you just linked the other puzzle, the wages puzzle. We heard from the New South Wales Treasurer about all the investment that's going on in New South Wales and how low the unemployment rate is, but wages growth in New South Wales, despite having those very favourable characteristics, remains quite low. Is that a concern to you?
On the first, how confident? Well, provided the ABS doesn't revise the statistics from under us again, it's been growing for the past 2 years. So, it's not an issue of confidence. It is actually growing. Have reasonable expectation that's going to continue to growing, not least of which because of the upswing in public investment has got a while to run yet. Probably not the right word to use, but there's quite a lot in the pipeline. There's actually not many pipes being built at the moment, it's mostly roads, but there is actually quite a lot in the pipeline. So that, I think, on that front, gives us a reasonable amount of confidence. It's not just New South Wales. It's actually evident pretty much in every state in Australia at the moment. And the Commonwealth is obviously facilitating as well. So I know Glenn, Stevens in particular, spent a lot of time banging on about infrastructure spending, and it would, don't get much better circumstances than this to actually do it. And maybe it was related to him and Phil talking about it, or maybe they just got around to it themselves. But we are actually seeing that now pretty much right across the country. So that part of the upswing in business investment, I think, it's there. It's actually in the data, and it doesn't show any sign of going away anytime soon. One thing which you are picking up related to that and related to what you said about what's happening in New South Wales, so there are some signs of pockets, and I would only call them pockets, where you are starting to see labour shortages and people actually thinking about paying higher wages, and that is related to in areas related to particularly to infrastructure spending, and partly because you've got these large projects going on in different parts of the country at the same time. That is, we are starting to see or hear some sign that's generating a little bit of labour shortage. But while it's generating labour shortage, not obviously spilling over into higher wages yet, but it is at least crossing the radar screen in a way that it hasn't done for quite some time. Whether that becomes more widespread than that, that is, as we said on Friday, as we said any number of times, that remains one of the great uncertainties. And as I said, it's not a local story, it's as much a global story. No one has any particular, there are economies where spare capacity in the labour market is much less or even non-existent than it is here, but you don't see much sign of wage pressure in those countries yet. And so we're a little behind that, and it's a question of whether those same dynamics play out here as played out elsewhere, you know, in the US or in Japan or UK or Germany. Sorry, the question back there.
I wanted to, Tim Lay from UBS, Dr. DeBell, thanks for your thoughts. I wanted to ask your thoughts on macroprudential policy and the bank's thoughts more broadly. How effective do you think it's been, and what do you think is the sort of landscape going forward in that part of the economy?
I think most of the measures over the last few years have been designed to increase resilience. And I'd say in that respect, they probably have been effective. If you look most recently at the share, you know, we're concerned about the large share of interest-only loans in the economy. And so APRA introduced that cap on interest-only loans, and that cap has now been met in the September quarter. And that, I think, has increased the resilience of the borrowing in the economy. So, that's the filter I would mostly, I think, is the one worth looking at all this through, is increasing the resilience of the economy. And I think the measures which have been taken to date, I would say the answer is yes, and that's the same prism that I'd be thinking about things going forward. So I said the measures to date, I think, have achieve that objective, but it's, you know, got to continually assess how things are going. But as I said, so far, I think the direction of change has been good in that respect. Anyone down the back, Mr. Crawford.
Dr. Bell, thank you. James Crawford from CFS-GAM. We heard from the Treasurer about the regulatory impediments to doing business in Australia. Any thoughts on the bank on whether this is also affecting business investment?
If you actually reference this in my talk, but didn't actually talk about it, I think it was either put out by Commonwealth Treasury or all the treasurers together, including the New South Wales Treasurer, just last week or the week before. And it looks exactly at that issue, as what are some of the impediments and what are some of the regulatory impediments. So I would direct you to have a look at that. And then I suppose not unrelated to that was that the Productivity Commission sometime in the last week or two put out their 5-yearly assessment, and they identify in a number of sectors of the economy some of the potential regulatory impediments to business investment and then hence productivity. So I wouldn't by no means profess to be an expert on that, so I would direct you to the people who are experts on that, which are the Productivity Commission, and it's not, Gary Banks had this long list of stuff, it's not quite that long list, but all those things on Gary Banks's list are pretty much still there in the most recent Productivity Commission report as potential impediments to productivity growth in Australia. And so, you know, as I said, I would direct you to those who know this issue better than I, and both of those two things are worth having a read as to some of those potential impediments. All right. Maybe one more in the middle there.
Hi, thank you. Thomas Leiting from Capital Group. You mentioned that small non-mining investment has not followed what the world's been doing. What are some of the other reasons why that hasn't been the case? You mentioned borrowing costs, but it seems to be really the crux of the issue why we haven't been seeing a lot more investment over the last couple of years.
Yeah. I don't think it's not so much borrowing cost, I think, as actually the availability of credit for that part. For the small business sector. Again, so we've run panel of small business talking to them about access to credit for 2 decades now. And I chaired it for 10 years up until I took my current job. And one thing I think which is interesting about that is that all of those people on our small business panel, It's a particularly biased sample. We actually get people who are basically have won Telstra Small Business Award, so they're actually good. And they have trouble getting finance. And you're thinking, if these people are having trouble, they're very successful small business entrepreneurs, they are having trouble accessing finance, be it from banks or venture capital or other sources of finance. And so, I always find it extraordinary that if these people are having trouble with clearly, well, what I think at least, are clearly successful businesses with good prospects, and they're having trouble financing growth. And it's very much around that. So it's not so much the availability of small business finance to sort of to keep running your business. It's very much around the availability of finance for growth. And I think that's been, I think it's basically the crux of the problem, is that they can run their business and they can get the finance to keep sustaining their business in its current state. But to move up to that next level, which does, which has got uncertainty around it, they can't really project the cash flows because they are inherently uncertain in the future. That seems to be where the greatest impediment is for investment in that sector of the economy. And it's in my talk, but I didn't show it there. The small businesses, guys and girls, account for actually a pretty large chunk of overall investment spending in the economy. So it does matter for the aggregate story. And so I do think a lot of it really does boil down to the availability of finance. I don't think it's not the absence of entrepreneurial spirit, it's the absence of entrepreneurial finance, I think, which has been the main factor holding that part of the economy back. And I really, so in their case, I really do think it is that one signal factor. They've got inherent uncertainty. They know that. They're comfortable in managing that. They're generally optimistic about the future, so that's not an impediment to growth. What it boils down to is basically the availability of finance. And so I think in their case, there is just one primary explanation for the absence of investment spending. Okay. I might leave it there.